some are long holds, some are short holds. Okay, yeah, question. Somebody had a question? No? Oh, okay. Let me just say that welcome to Bio 241, and it is August 18th. This is our first lecture session for human physiology. Yeah, question. Is there extra credit in here? Probably not. What I really want you to do is you're going to be busy enough studying the required materials. Every once in a while, maybe there's some extra credit. You know, if I make a mistake on something, then maybe I might turn it into an extra credit problem. But even if you read the syllabus, it says that if a lab instructor gives you extra credit, the lecture instructor has the capability to not count that extra credit. All right, so generally speaking, we don't have much extra credit in here, but every once in a while, yeah. And even the lab instructors don't have the freedom really to give you extra credit. Okay, so not much in the way of extra credit. Okay. All right, so the nice thing about the syllabus is once you download it as a Word file, notice that if you hit the control button, that link becomes activated, so you can use this Word document with its hyperlinks in it to get to these websites if you want. So that's really handy. Here's a textbook that you need, and here is the lab book that you need that's Integrate. I think it's still a green color. That's by Professor Spooner. I'm not sure this is any longer available to you, the Physio EX, so I think we're going to be providing copies of this for you in lab, but talk to your lab instructor to find out the latest on that. Question? Yeah. The 10th edition. Okay. Let's talk about that right now. There are different editions out there, but if you look at the study guide, and I think I passed the study guide out to you already, it lists at the end of the chapter the study questions. And also, it gives you exam figures that you have to study. Okay? Because I might photocopy an exam figure, erase the labels, put it on the test, and then you have to relabel it by matching a column to an unlabeled figure. And so if you use a different edition of the book, guess what they do? They change the figure numbers. And sometimes they change around the end of chapter questions or the answers. So if you use that edition, it's generally pretty good. But if you take off of my study guide a figure number, it might not correspond to your book, and so you'll be studying the wrong information. So I don't necessarily recommend Fox 10. Right? Because things are changed in a subtle way that lead you astray. But if you're interested to know, there is a copy of Fox 11, maybe two or three copies in the reserve section of the library. You can check it out for a couple hours and just compare them side by side. Right? And if there is a discrepancy, go ahead and make a photocopy of that page and then use a photocopy. All right? So you got to be careful. But probably you want to bring your books to campus during lab, or you can use a friend's book in lab as well to find out what the correspondence is between. It's not exactly. Yeah.
What about other international editions, like European?
Yeah, when I look at an international edition, usually it's in a big red bullet that says the content has been changed from the North American edition. All right, so there's a disclaimer right on the front. Most of the times when I page through it, page by page, you know, letter by letter, it's exactly the same. All right, so you got to be really careful. Okay, so an international edition might be exactly the same, but they say it isn't, but it really might be exactly the same. You just got to be, again, proactive and check it out for yourself. Okay, so I don't mind people using paperback editions in here because you might be able to save $100, right? Maybe even more, maybe even $150, something like that. All right, and during lab, that would be a perfect time to do that. So you got to know those exam figures and the end of chapter questions. So you know what? Some of these labs that you're going to be doing this semester, you might get done within the 3-hour time period. Don't leave lab early. Sit around with your friends and your lab instructor. Go over those questions, because if you know the answers to those questions, what is that to you? Well, it's gold, right? Then you get points on a test. Right, so don't leave lab early. Network with your friends and your lab instructor. If you have a question about it, question on the end of the chapter or online, ask your lab instructor and go over it. Right, don't just leave lab early. And the same thing for the exam figures. If you got extra time in lab, go over those exam figures. You know, test each other in lab afterwards. Right, because there's no better time than the present to gain facility with this information. All right, so back to the syllabus. Here's a link to Gateway and then Blackboard. Notice no www in those things right there. We got objectives, email etiquette. Oh, this is real important. As you see, I'm teaching a lot of classes. I have like 14 different sections and 5 different classes. So if you email me and say, hey, what are we really having a test in your class tomorrow? Guess what? I won't have a clue. I mean, I might know who you are, but I won't have a clue what test you're talking about, what class you're talking about. So it's important in the subject field at the beginning of every email address, put your name, the course number, and the CRN number so that I can get to that information really quick. All right. Otherwise, I just won't have a clue what to do. Attendance, you got to be here. All right. And read through that. Grading, this is important. All right. So I'll go over this a little bit. Lecture is 75% of your grade, and that means lab is going to be worth 25% of your grade right here. You're going to have a number of lab quizzes, and that's up to the lab instructor. Some lab instructors might have one right at the beginning, so that helps everybody get the class right at the start, and they might have another quiz at the end. If people are leaving early, maybe they might elect to have a quiz at the end, maybe 2 quizzes for every lab meeting. So you might have more than 16 quizzes, but in any case, no matter how many quizzes you take during the semester, your lab is going to be worth 160 points. So at the end, we'll figure out, your lab instructor will figure out a percentage, and then he'll multiply that percentage by 160 points to find out the total points for that particular part of the class. So if you get 50% on all the quizzes in lab, how many points are you going to get? Yeah, so 160 times 50% or divided by 2 is 80 points. If you get 100% on your quizzes, how many points are you going to get for lab? 160, even though you only got 100%, right? So you got to multiply the percentage by the number of points to figure that out. All right, so don't get misled by that. And every lecture test is going to be worth 100 points. So the percentage for tests are exactly equal to the number of points that you get. And then the grading is just a strict 90-80-70 scale based out of 660 points for the class. So that's how you're going to be graded in here. Lab quizzes and lecture exams. So no term papers, don't get credit for attendance, but you have to come to class in order to take the tests, right? So you don't have a privilege to take a test unless you show up in class. And every time I'll have a sign-in sheet for you to sign in, and the lab instructor is going to do the same thing. Academic honesty is a real important issue. Don't look around the room when you're taking quizzes, right? Don't write notes on your hand or any place like that. No sunglasses, hoods, hats. All electronic devices have to be turned off. Oops. All right, make sure they're turned off in lecture and for sure during a test. Don't put your PDA in vibrate mode because you're expecting an important call, or airplane mode, or test-taking mode, or any kind of mode. If it's in any kind of mode, all right, we consider that cheating. Right, make sure it's powered off, because we've had students access the internet during tests, and that's just unfair to people that are taking the test for by themselves, right? So it's just individual effort. Most of these things you can read. Emergency procedures, of course, that's really important. And so if there is an emergency, the advice is to take all your belongings with you, because we might not be able to get back in the room. And even if it's a drill, take your stuff with you, and then proceed out a safe exit. That's the important, that's the key term. Proceed out a safe exit. Do not proceed out an unsafe exit, right? Like one that's falling down or in flames. So that's pretty, I think, obvious, but I have to tell people that. Okay. Read all this other important information. Most important thing here is make sure you get to me this week in writing if you don't want me to record lectures. Withdrawal policy, that's really up to you. A lot of people need recommendations later on in their life, a year or two after they take the class. Please read this, all right, if you want me to write a recommendation for you later on. I'll need to know your CRN number and the semester and the course number. Otherwise, I won't be able to find you. Okay. And here is the tentative schedule. That means it might change because I'm really talking way too long here. On this administrative material, we're going to talk about introduction and homeostasis today, August 18th, good, got that right. And when is the first exam?
September
8th. What chapters is it going to cover?
1, 2, 3,
and then we skip to 6. All right, so that's what we're going to cover on that particular exam. All right, so you know how to read this schedule right here. Here's the final, and then here is the schedule for your lab. All right, so you can go ahead and look this information over. And there's a hard copy. If there's any extras in the back row, go ahead and pass them down to the front. Okay? All right, so does anybody have any questions on the syllabus, where you find information? So one real important absolute goal for today, or this week actually, is to make sure you can log into Blackboard. And I have office hours right after this class. If you want to practice on this computer, there might be a class right after this one, or around where my office is. About 49% of the time, the password that you use for WebStar works for Blackboard. 51% of the time, who knows what it is, and it has to be changed. And I can change it for, actually you can come by my office and you can change it for yourself. All right, so if you can't log in, it might just be that your password didn't get transferred from WebStar into Blackboard properly, something glitched up. But make sure that that's a goal for this week that you accomplish, that you can log into Blackboard and start getting that study information and start preparing for the first test for yourself. All right? And so make sure that you see me. Some of the lab instructors might not know enough about Blackboard to help you log in by changing your password. Okay, but I certainly can do that. Any questions? No? Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what? You can use a Fullerton College ID card as well. Okay.
What if you're
only in class? Yeah, it's $2.50 for an ID. And this is why I do that. It's almost like a legal requirement for me to do it for the following reason. Okay, it's a little obscure. It's kind of hidden. But when you go buy an aspirin at the drugstore, you kind of think you're paying the pharmaceutical company, the drug company, maybe the drugstore, some money for that aspirin. But who else are you really paying for that aspirin? You're paying a lawyer. Okay, you're going to see a bunch of type on the aspirin bottle. For instance, when you go see a doctor and you have to write this huge bill to see a doctor, you think you're paying a doctor or a hospital. Well, who else are you paying? You're paying a lawyer. Okay. And when you sign up for college classes at a college, you think you're paying the college to attend that college. Who else are you paying? Bunch of lawyers, okay, as well as the college. I mean, so every time there's a transaction in the United States, lawyers are getting a big cut of the money. And so since I teach a number of online classes and I require my online students to provide picture ID, I'm obligated to treat all my students exactly the same way, otherwise I'm going to have a talk with a lawyer, and I don't really want to do that. So I require all my students, whether they're on campus or online students, to provide a picture ID, either Fullerton College or Cypress College ID. Okay, so it's kind of a legal requirement that I could get into if I don't handle it just that way. Okay, so I just got to treat all my students exactly the same. Okay. $2.50. I know that can be a little bit of a hassle because, I take classes here too, and I've been trying to get a picture ID, and you need a little stamp someplace on it, and they said they mailed the stamps out to me, but they never came, and so I understand it can be a little bit of a hassle, but it's cheap. It's only $2.50 for an ID. Okay. All right, so any other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think they're all available right now. So I tell you what, let's go back. Let's go back. Blackboard? How do I look at Blackboard? And then it's under course documents. All right, so here, and then here are PowerPoint slides. And then here are all the PowerPoints for this particular class. I might modify or add to this a little bit. There's even one for this lab. Okay, here's lab one. I don't have a lot of PowerPoints. For labs, the lab instructors usually do a lot of instruction, but that first lab is so important because we introduce the concept of homeostasis that I want to make sure that everybody studies those PowerPoints, even the lab PowerPoints for the first lecture test that we have in here. I've incorporated some into my lecture. and those are not in your textbook. So if I use figures that are not in your textbook, I'll give you a hard copy of, maybe in a PowerPoint or something like that. Okay, so you have that information. You don't have to look that up on the internet. But there's a lot of good information on the internet nonetheless. Okay, so all of these are here. They should be here. If for whatever reason your particular section got gypped, let me know and I can troubleshoot it and see what's wrong. All right, so here's a PowerPoint. Oh, wait, I need to. That's it. So we're ready for lecture, right? Okay. I don't think I have this many students in class. I only have four sections. But anyway. All right, so we're primarily interested in human physiology. Every once in a while, I might talk about some other kind of physiology, some other kinds of animals. We call that comparative physiology or comparative anatomy when we compare ourselves to how other organisms function, and there's quite a bit of difference between different species. So once you understand the human body and look at other species, it's like going to another planet to see how other organisms function. It's quite amazing. Right, but let's focus our attention on human physiology. And physiology is just the scientific study on how your body functions or how it works. Right, as opposed to anatomy, which you have already passed because that's a prerequisite for this class, that's a scientific study of structure. But you should realize that there's always a relationship between structure and function. And we're going to really explore that theme in this class almost every day. So I guess I forgot to mention something during when we were looking at the syllabus. Right, make sure that you've had past anatomy with at least a C. And what really helps in this class is that you've taken a chemistry class, even a college-level chemistry class. And I always, that's not a prerequisite for the class, it's just a personal recommendation. And I've never had a single student ever come back to me and tell me that that was a waste of time for them. Because chemistry is a basic discipline for physiology. Right, physiology is not something that's fundamental to chemistry. Chemistry is fundamental to how we function. So chemistry is really, really helpful. Right, so if you're thinking whether or not you're going to stay in the class, okay, you might seriously consider taking a chemistry class before this one. High school chemistry certainly will help, but college chemistry will help even more. All right, so physiology is a study of how the body functions. Pathophysiology is a study of how physiologic processes are altered by disease and injury. And we'll mention some prevalent and important disease processes that affect our population when we go through the class. Like, can anybody think of a pathology that affects a lot of people? Cancer. Yeah, cancer is one pathophysiologic process. Like diabetes mellitus is another one. Regulation of blood sugar is very important. Okay, so those are just a couple examples that we'll talk about during this class. Okay, and I want to talk a little bit about scientific method in here. Probably a lot of science classes talk about scientific method, and I want to just touch on some of the important salient parts of the scientific method. Here are the steps that a scientist would have to use to gain some valuable information about the world or about how our physiology works. All right, first, we have to form a testable hypothesis about our observations. So someplace we're going to be living our lives, and we might see some kind of repeated pattern that happens all the time. Like, for instance, you might realize, well, when your work schedule changes and you have to work till 1 o'clock in the morning, right, as opposed to maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you come down with a cold. All right, so you might say, well, gee whiz, there's something relating these extended work hours with my reduced resistance. Right, so you might notice, you might have a hunch about how something works in your body. Right, so you develop that hunch, and that would be what we call a hypothesis. So a hypothesis is unproven. It's just what? It's just kind of a guess on how you think the world operates based on your experience. So it's really nothing scientific about it. It's just a good guess. Right, so then you have to think about, how can you prove or disprove this hypothesis? So you have to conduct and analyze experiments to test the hypothesis. Wait a second, I got to change my arrow option. I forgot, pointer options, arrow options. Okay, there, that's not so obnoxious now. All right, so you have to think of ways to test the hypothesis. All right, so you might want to get a whole bunch of people, have a bunch of people work till 1 o'clock in the morning, have another group work till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and just see what the incidence of them coming down with a cold or flu is, right, and see if it really does make sense. All right, and so then you look at the results and you draw conclusions whether or not the results support the hypothesis. All right, and then if that can be repeated by a lot of people doing the exact same kind of experiment, maybe making some modifications to it all over the world, you can say that extended schedules, work schedules, make you less resistant to colds or viruses. All right, so you might want to say, well, nobody should work past 11 o'clock at night. Okay, maybe we'd be a healthier, safer world. All right, so then if there's a lot of groups that support your hypothesis, it can be developed into a theory. And a theory is a generally accepted way of thinking of the world. All right, so it's a general statement explaining some kind of natural phenomena that's based on a proven hypothesis. So a lot of times we use these terms incorrectly in our society. A lot of times you might have a hunch about how something operates, and in everyday conversation, what do you hear from a friend? Oh, I have a theory about how this works. Or I have a theory about how I can get into a class, get an ad code. Okay, if you follow this and that or whatever, I have a theory. But is that really a theory?
No,
it's really just a guess, right? That's an hypothesis. And probably the reason why nobody says, oh, I have a hypothesis about something, is that it's difficult to say, right, without getting tongue-tied. All right, so a theory has a lot more validity behind it because it's been proven by experimentation. And as a matter of fact, when you, in order for something to become a theory, if it's in the scientific community, you have to publish it in a journal, and there are people that want to disprove it. They're going to try really hard to disprove your hypothesis. So it's going to undergo the rigors of critique, right? And it can be a very brutal technique. And if it survives all that critique, then it's something that can actually become a theory that people can rely on. So, I don't know if I have that on the next slide or not, but basically, here I have a question for you. What's the purpose of the scientific method? All right, it seems really complicated and it's rigorous and it kind of cramps your style. But what's the reason for the scientific method? And it's really a marvelous thing because it gives you, reliable information. It gives you reliable information. It's information that you can, you know, schedule your life around, and it will change your life because it's valid as opposed to unreliable information. Like, for instance, I could say, I have a stock tip for you. And if you buy 1 million shares of Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Company, those shares are going to go up 100% by next week. Okay, so that's information. All right, and then somebody's going to go buy those shares, spend all that money, and then the stock goes down. All right, and then they come back to you and say, well, why did you tell me that? And then I could say, well, you know what? That wasn't a theory. That was just a hypothesis. Okay? So, you know, if it was a theory, then there would be some evidence. It would be reliable that that situation would actually take place. All right? So you want to listen to theory. You don't want to just listen to hypotheses, you know, unless you're interested in trying to prove a particular hypothesis. All right, so the scientific method gives you reliable information. So if you act on that information, it will be of benefit to you. All right, and if you rely on unreliable information, one that's just based on hunches and guesses and hypotheses, then it won't be of any benefit to you. Or may not be. Chances are it won't even be of any benefit to you. All right, so that's the purpose of the scientific method, to give you information that you can count on. And that's really important in this particular class, because you got a big textbook that you got to work through this semester. All of the information in your textbook is at the level of a theory. It's just not hypothesis. So it's undergone the rigors of what we're talking about, the scientific method. So, and I might tell you some things that are hypotheses in class, right? Some hunches that I might have, but I'll let you know ahead of time that it's a hypothesis and not a theory, and it has to be worked out. But your textbook has proven information, information that you can rely on. So that's particularly important. All right, so when you test a hypothesis, you have to have two groups of people that you're testing this hypothesis on. One will be the control group, and the other will be an experimental group. And we use that because whenever, for instance, if we're going to test out a drug, and somebody gives you a drug, there's always a percentage, because you're giving attention to somebody, and maybe you have a nice expression on your face, there's going to be some positive aspect to that drug, even though it's a sugar pill, a placebo. All right, so we want to subtract the effect of giving us a placebo, a drug that will have no effect on you, from and the experimental group to find out what the true benefit of that particular therapy is for a particular group of patients. All right, so there's always going to be a control group to be scientific method. All right, so a lot of times you might hear on the news, well, we do a lot of polling to find out if the population likes this particular plan that's going through Congress, or if they like a candidate or not like a candidate. All right, so they call up people and ask them, do you like this candidate? They say yes or no. And on the news they say, oh yeah, we've conducted scientific polling, so we believe that we know this information is accurate. All right, but is that a scientific method? No, that's just calling somebody up and asking them what their opinion is. There is no experimental group, there's no control group. So it's really not scientific method. So people use this term scientific when there's really nothing scientific about it whatsoever. All right, so science requires control groups and experimental groups. The measurements, the best measurements are quantitative, right, where you can actually get a number for something and not just say, well, it's hot or cold, but what would you like to measure? You'd actually use a thermometer and actually get a measurement. Right, and actually use a thermometer that's calibrated, that's accurate and precise, so that you have good numbers to report. And blindly, what does that mean? For instance, if somebody is testing out a pharmaceutical and one is a placebo, one is the active ingredient, the person that's administering that particular medication, they can know that they're in an experiment, but they should never know what group they're in. All right, because if I'm giving a placebo and I know it's a waste of time, I might say, oh yeah, well, here's a new important drug for your particular disease. Make sure you take it every day, right? Or they might go to another group and say, oh yeah, here's a new experimental drug that I want you to take, right, every day. Make sure you take it every single day, all right? I said exactly the same thing, but what was the meaning of what I said? Two different kinds of information. One, the first time I said it kind of lackadaisically, and I conveyed that information by my facial expression and how I verbalized it, that, you know, it's probably going to be a waste of your time. The second time, I was enthusiastic. So the placebo effect is not exactly the same in those both groups. So the person that's administering the test should not know which one is going to work and which one supposedly is going to work. Okay? So that's what we mean by blind. And then analysis of the data using statistics, that's just another systematic way of making sure that a person's subjective analysis or impressions don't influence the data and the outcome of the results, right? So statistics is blind to a person's expectations or enthusiasm, right, because it's systematic. All right, so if you go through all that, the bottom line is what kind of information?
Reliable.
Yes, reliable information. That's a good key word, reliable information. All right, so when we have a new drug that has some benefit, okay, we first test these drugs on animal models. And there's quite a few people that have ethical objections to using animals for testing when we don't know what the results are going to be. All right, but we have to test a drug for its effectiveness and toxicity. First in tissues, right? So cells that are alive, but they're not organisms, to see if there's any deleterious effects of these particular chemicals on living cells. And if it's proven to be safe and effective on cells, then we go to other kinds of animals, like rats and mice, to find out if rats and mice might be hurt by these particular drugs. And I hope you all see that that's some benefit to humanity, because what happens if a drug is toxic and we administer it to humans first? What are we doing? We're hurting people. Okay, so that's really bad. So we want to avoid hurting people. And then after it passes these tests, we can start to test these drugs on people. But again, it's in a very controlled manner, very safe manner. So you see a number of phases, four different phases for drug testing. And all of these are trying to find, is this particular therapy safe and effective in these beginning clinical trials? So phase one trials, where toxicity and the metabolism is tested in healthy human volunteers, somebody that isn't sick. And we know that this drug is not going to be of any benefit to them, but it should not hurt them one way or the other. Phase two, the effectiveness and toxicity is tested in a very small target population, those people that we think would maybe experience the most benefit, all right? But these people are sick, all right? And then if it still passes, we don't find any deleterious effects, meaning what, bad effects, then there's widespread test of the drug in a diverse population. And then phase four, the drug is tested for other potential uses. And as a matter of fact, if there is a drug that is FDA approved, it will be monitored in perpetuity, which means what? Forever. Whenever the FDA allows a drug to be used in a clinical situation, if there's any deleterious effects, if it ever hurts anybody, then there has to be reports written and then mailed into the FDA so that they, even if it's 200 years later, so that we can make sure that these drugs are always going to be safe and effective, because maybe somebody misses something later on down the line. So anything that's FDA approved, you see there's a rigorous schedule of controls to make sure that these drugs are safe and effective, and you can imagine the expense of that. Right? They cost millions of dollars to bring a drug to market because of all these tests. Unlike food supplements that you might read in the newspaper that you can pick up at the health food store, you know, like maybe ginkgo biloba or echinacea and things like that, right? We really don't know what the effects of these particular compounds are, except by hearsay and just by reading some labels, so we don't really know. So there's not really the same kind of quality control, all right, with food supplements compared to FDA-approved drugs. And I think all the drugs that we're going to talk in here are FDA-approved, all the kinds of therapies that we're going to talk about in this particular class. Okay, now, herbal supplements, they can be very powerful, like echinacea, ginkgo biloba, if it's used properly, right? And so if you're interested in knowing something about that, then you should go and talk to somebody that is educated in that realm of medicine. So who is educated? What group of people have thousands of years of experience with herbal medicine? That would be, for instance, like a practitioner in traditional Oriental or traditional Chinese or traditional Asian medicine. I don't even know how to talk about it exactly correctly, all right? But somebody from Asia that has, right, a medical degree, that has studied years and years and years and has studied all the thousands of different kinds of herbal medications and probably knows something about acupuncture, acupressure, and all of that kind of stuff. And that's a very important and well-recognized form of treating people. As a matter of fact, maybe it's best for me to say Western medicine versus Eastern medicine, if you could kind of put it in your mind that way. But so in the United States, it's primarily Western medicine. In Asia, primarily Eastern, okay? And it's well recognized that Eastern way of treating people is much better for certain kinds of conditions compared to Western medicine, like chronic pain. In Western medicine, we almost know nothing about how to treat somebody with chronic pain as compared to a more Eastern tradition. So you should, and I don't cover any of that in this particular class, so if you're interested, you'll have to expand out and find this other information at other places. Okay. All right, so let's start our journey with Western medicine, okay? And a good concept right here to talk about is homeostasis. And homeostasis is a big word, and stasis just means staying the same, and homeo just means kind of being the same, so being the same while staying the same. But it's really kind of an advanced concept. And let me just tell you the basic concept and then give you my impression of what homeostasis really means. And this is what you're going to cover in today's lab. So homeostasis is a condition in which body parameters such as blood pressure and pH, your temperature, fluids, and a bunch of other factors of your internal environment are maintained within a range suitable to support life. So that's what homeostasis is. So right now, what can you tell me about your body temperature? Are you at room temperature? Are you above or below? Are you fluctuating around or what? You're above. You're above room temperature, right? Because you're way up at 98.6, something around there, maybe 98.8, something like that. And so your body temperature is a lot different than the environment. And if you were to measure it, it should stay pretty much constant. And as a matter of fact, if it does vary, if it does go up, right, that's an indication of a disease state, right? And infection could be one of the things, right? So body temperature, if it goes up or down, that's an indication of a disease state. But if it's right at 98.8, that's an indication of maintaining a healthy state inside your body. Well, you might have other pathologies in your body that don't affect your temperature, but if your temperature varies, for sure that's a disease state. Okay, but homeostasis is a dynamic state. All right, so we just said for homeostasis, everything in your body should stay the same, like your body temperature. All right, but now we got to layer onto that some other concepts, and that is that things are changing all the time in your body. And so homeostasis means that the important parameters in your body fluctuate a little bit. They vary just a little bit, but not drastically. And they fluctuate in a certain way to compensate other changes that are taking place in your body. So, for instance, when your body temperature goes up, all right, if you're in a healthy state, something else has to change in you to bring your temperature down. Like, what would change in you to bring your temperature down? So you start sweating, right? So again, right, you're starting, the beginning of sweating is a change in your internal environment. It's a change in you, but what it's doing is bringing your temperature back down to where it should be. All right, so that's an example how all things in your body change so that nothing changes in a big way. All right, so your body systems are working and constantly adjusting to changing internal and external conditions. So the way that I think about homeostasis is that I think about a bunch of parameters like temperature and blood pressure and water concentration, ion concentrations in your body, right? And we can measure all of these. You have a certain level of all these different compounds, but they're not absolutely flat and unchanging. What are they doing? They're fluctuating up and down. All of them are fluctuating up and down so that none of them go beyond this normal range that is suitable to support your life. So I think of homeostasis as being like a dance of all these different parameters that are dancing around each other, constantly adjusting so that nothing has to change drastically. All right, so that's why we call it a dynamic state. It's not absolutely constant. It's little fluctuation so that nothing changes in a really big way. All right, so you'll have to read and ponder that term homeostasis for quite a bit to really appreciate it. But we'll give you some things to study. All right, reflexes help maintain homeostasis in our body. And some reflexes are what we call long-range reflexes. So here's a slide that's not in your book, but I think it is an exam figure nonetheless. All right, so I do want you to know what these signaling molecules are called. So here we have a cell that wants to signal the rest of your body to help control, maintain homeostasis. This is what we call an endocrine cell. All right, it's a hormone-secreting gland cell, so we call that an endocrine cell. It secretes a product outside the cell. What do we call this space outside the cell? Anybody know what that's called? That's the extracellular space, right, or interstitial space. Maybe we talked about some of this in anatomy. And this particular compound we call a hormone, and it's a hormone because it gets picked up by a blood vessel. Now, what kind of blood vessel can pick up a hormone? Can it be an artery? Can it be a vein? No, it's got to be a capillary. right? Because a capillary is specialized for exchange. What do you know about a structure of a capillary that allows it to undergo exchange? It is? It's the thinnest wall of all those blood vessels, right? So remember all your different layers of a blood vessel? And the capillary only has one layer, and that's the endothelium. And some capillaries are even more permeable than others because some are fenestrated, some are sinusoid, some are continuous. If that terminology isn't ringing a bell, break out your anatomy book. Okay, but the capillary is what? The functional space for exchange in a blood vessel because it's really, really thin. It doesn't have all those different layers. So a capillary can pick up a hormone, and then once it's in the blood, where does it go? The hormone. Everywhere in the body. It's delivered everywhere in the body. And it can leave through another capillary, and then it can bind to a cell and signal a change in metabolism of a distant cell, someplace, a faraway place in your body. And that cell is what we call a target cell. Not all cells are target cells. Cells are target cells when they have a receptor for this particular hormone. Okay, and we're going to spend the rest of this class talking about different kinds of receptors and where you find them and all that kind of stuff. So if you're not familiar with the receptor concept, we'll get to that pretty quickly. All right, so this is a hormone secreted by an endocrine gland. We can have nerve cells that secrete signaling molecules. So a nerve impulse can reach this, what's a terminal end of this neuron right here called? Okay. Well, remember from anatomy, these little small processes are dendrites. This long one right here is called an axon. So this would be the axon terminus. All right, so don't forget any of that prerequisite information. So this hormone, this nerve cell, when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, it will be stimulated to release a chemical compound, but it's not really called a hormone, right? We're going to call it, because it's released from a neuron, it's going to start with neuro, and we call it a neurotransmitter. It's going to diffuse across a synapse, and it's going to bind to another neuron or an effector cell to change its metabolism. Right? So this neurotransmitter diffuses only a very short distance. Right? So a neurotransmitter is another kind of signaling molecule. Now here's a pretty interesting example. Here we have another nerve cell, and it's going to secrete a compound. So what would we like to call this compound if it's secreted by a nerve cell? It's going to be neuro something, right? Now, so what's the big difference between this endocrine cell and this neuron right here? What is a neuron specialized to do? Conduct electrical impulses. This gland cell is not specialized to do that, right? So that's the big difference between this gland cell and a neuron. Neuron can conduct electrical information. And when that electrical impulse reaches the axon terminus, it releases a product. But in this particular case, right, that product is picked up by a capillary and it's carried all over the body. So what would you like to call this particular signaling molecule? Is it a good example of a hormone because it's picked up by the blood? Or is it a good example of a neurotransmitter because it's released by a neuron? The terminology is a little confusing. Right? You can't just say one or the other. So we say, guess what? That is a neurohormone. Right? So neurohormones are released by neurons, but nonetheless, they're picked up by the blood and distributed everywhere in the body. Right? So sometimes things don't automatically fit in nice little cubby holes. All right, in terms of short-range control, sometimes we call this local control. All right, so long-range, a lot of times we call reflexes because they occur over very long distances. Local control just means within the distance of a couple cells. So if there is a cell someplace that secretes a compound that can signal a neighboring cell to change its metabolism, we generally call that a paracrine agent. All right? And those could be neurotransmitters, they could be hormones. But if it's very, very local, it's going to be a paracrine. So paracrine is the most general form of this particular kind of signaling molecule. And a matter of fact, some cells can secrete a product that will bind to a receptor right on the cell membrane of the cell that secretes it, that then changes the activity of the cell that secreted that particular agent. We call that an autocrine agent. So an autocrine controls helps regulate the cell that actually secreted that particular signaling molecule. Okay, so I could photocopy any of these two diagrams, put them on the test, and if I whited this out, what would you want to put on the test right here? Yeah, autocrine agent, right? So that would be an example of what you might find on the test. All right, so what does this have to do with homeostasis? Well, it has to do with that concept of dynamic constancy, right? So, and this figure is from your book. This is a figure that you have in your book. It's a condition that that is stabilized above or below some physiologic set point. So here we can see a variation in some kind of parameter. Maybe this could be temperature, for instance. And if we look at the average temperature, this is the average temperature. But if we measure your temperature, you can see that it goes above and below the normal, okay, temperature right here. And this average is what we call the set point. So every physiologic system in your body has a set point. And if we see that it can vary above or below the set point, but when it starts to deviate above the set point, what happens to this particular parameter? Where do we see it go? Does it continue to increase? No. It actually starts to be compensated, and this parameter starts to go back, retreat back down to the set point. All right, because of something called feedback. So if there is a variation in a parameter and we see that it's varying around the set point, that's due to a negative feedback loop. All right, so when you hear that term negative, what kind of connotation does that have to you, good or bad? Kind of has a bad connotation. But in terms of control system theory, negative feedback is actually a very good and beneficial kind of feedback to have, because it's going to drive a parameter back to a set point, which is what? The absolute most healthy condition to be at. So negative feedback is beneficial. Positive feedback, on the other hand, means that this parameter is going to be driven farther and farther and farther away from the set point. And it might be driven so far away from the set point and out of the normal range right here that it's going to produce a disease state, and it might even be a lot worse than that. It might even produce death. Okay, so even temperature, people die of hyperthermia, people die of hypothermia if they lose homeostasis in their body. Right? And one of the most important conditions that produce hyperthermia and even hypothermia will be the hydration state. If somebody becomes dehydrated, then they're much more susceptible to hyperthermia and can overheat as a result of that. Okay. So let's look at a feedback loop. I want you to absolutely know the components of a feedback loop. All right, and in order for your body to appreciate some parameter, either inside your body or outside your body, for instance, if you want to observe this slide, I have light bouncing off of this screen right here, and if you want to observe that screen, what do you need? You need? Yeah, you need receptors, you need eyes, right, to see that light bouncing off, right? So you can't appreciate that slide there with your ears, right, or your fingertips or your tongue or whatever else. You need receptors for that particular modality, right? You need eyes. So a sensor, okay, detects some energy in your environment. So in order to measure pH, you need to have pH receptors. If you need to measure glucose in your body needs to have glucose receptors. And if your body wants to measure temperature, you need thermoreceptors. And if you don't have those receptors, then you're going to be oblivious to that particular kind of energy. All right, so a sensor picks up a stimulus. So in your notes, you might want to just say that X right here, all right, is a stimulus. It's going to be a change in some parameter. In order to notice this change, and here we can see what? An increase in some parameter. What do you need to notice a change in that parameter? You need a sensor, okay? A sensor is going to send that information maybe to the central nervous system. How does information get into the central nervous system? What kind of pathway is that? Is that afferent or efferent, sensory or motor? It's afferent, which means sensory. So here is an afferent pathway. You could write that down in here if you want. And then here is the integration center. That integration center has got a very important parameter that we call the set point. So someplace in your brain, there is a place that stores what your normal body temperature should be. Okay, and this integration center is going to compare information from the sensor and to see if there is an error. If the sensor reports that your body is 98.6, the integration center is going to say, oh, well, that's perfect body temperature. What decision does the integration center have to make if you're perfect? What kind of changes do you have to make? None whatsoever. All right, but if there's an error in that signal, the integration center has got to make a decision on what to do to bring your body temperature either up or down to where it should be. And so the integration center makes a decision and sends it out to the rest of your body. How does that information get out to the rest of your body? What kind of pathway? Efferent pathway. And efferent pathways connect to effectors. So what could be, what's an effector of your somatic nervous system? What's somatic? It means voluntary. I want to lift my arm up or I don't want to lift my arm up. That's voluntary. Okay, so what is the effector in your somatic nervous system? It is skeletal muscle, right? What are the effectors in the autonomic nervous system? You have glands. Yeah, glands. It's coming back. I want your anatomy to come back a little bit. Glands and what else? Cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. Those are the three effectors of your autonomic nervous system, right? And that integration center knows, well, it's going to send information out to all those different effectors. Like when you get cold, your skeletal muscles even shiver, right, to bring your body temperature back up. All right, and that's going to produce something right here, which is what we call a response. All right, so here is a nice feedback loop. So let's go over that. You got the stimulus, you got a sensor, afferent pathway, integration center with what? Integration center with, really important concept, integration center with, it's got something else, it's got the set point in there. So if you had lab already, maybe this is a lot, it's coming to you a lot easier, right? You're going to go over this again in lab. Integration center's got the set point. Integration center makes a decision on what to do, sends it out the efferent pathway to an effector, and the effector produces a response. So a response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends with a response. Yeah. All right, so I think I gotta stop really soon. Oh no, we can go to 10-2. Okay. So is X constant over time? It's going to change. Okay? But if homeostasis is being maintained, the way it changes is that it changes only within a normal range that's suitable to support life. And as soon as it starts to deviate above the set point, other mechanisms in your body take over and change, right, to bring that parameter back down to the set point. So homeostasis means that everything is changing all the time, but what? Only in little bits and pieces, so that nothing changes a lot. Because if your temperature went up, and your body said, well, you got to start sweating to bring your temperature down. But if you started sweating like 5 or 10 gallons of fluid, what would happen to you? Well, then you'd die of dehydration. Okay? So your body has to be smart in how it maintains homeostasis. Okay, so next time, remind me where to start. We're going to start with this figure is not in your textbook, but this is a really important exam figure because it shows you all those pieces of that response loop that we're talking about. This is a nice clear picture. All right, so that's it for today.